Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged, brought to you by Hedgeye Risk Management. Today is February 11th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Hello again. It's been another interesting week. The coronavirus is still looming over the markets, but global equities seem to be taking this all in stride. Not because of any really great economic news. In fact, I see certain things going on in the market behind the S&P headline that really worry me. Instead, I attribute the bullish surge last week to political news that the markets really liked. And that was a series of incredibly favorable outcomes for President Donald Trump. I mean, seriously, this has to have been the best week by far of the Trump presidency. So we'll talk about all this. And then as time goes by, I'd like to talk for a while about what's going on in the Democratic Party. The Democrats had an Iowa caucus a week ago Monday. They had another debate last Friday, and they're going to the polls in New Hampshire later today. Some would say that what's happening to the Democrats is nothing but good news for the Republicans. But I want to be more analytical than that. Yes, Bernie does seem to be a lot more likely now as the 2020 nominee. But before Republicans start celebrating, they should recall the glee with which Democrats celebrated the nomination of Donald Trump back in 2016. Ah, that's right. For Republicans, that might be a sobering thought. Among other things, we're going to be looking pretty carefully at the demographic profile of each of today's major candidates on the Democratic side. And in doing so, we're going to draw heavily on a Newswire story, basically a Pew Research analysis that we sent out yesterday. So all that and more to come. Okay, first, as we always do, let's look at markets. Over the last 5 days, the S&P 500 shook off bad news like a wet dog in your dining room. And yes, the S&P rose strongly on 4 out of those 5 days. Altogether, it powered up another 1.2%. Meanwhile, the global Dow was up 2.8%. Ah, that's more. But that was mainly Asia and Europe recovering from their huge losses the week before. Shanghai remains over 7% below its high a couple of weeks ago. Ditto for the rest of Asia. Europe still lags, but the S&P 500, wow, it continues to be the preferred game worldwide for equity investors. Once again, the S&P is setting daily all-time highs. Is all this bullishness really related to Trump? I think it may be, and I'll return to that point in a moment. But again, as I mentioned at the outset, not all the market signals are positive. First of all, the S&P volume has been thinning during the recent climb, and the VIX remains elevated. That suggests maybe lack of conviction. And more seriously, the dollar is rising along with the price of gold, which is never a good sign. And even worse, commodity prices are sinking. I mean, crude oil is now in bear market territory at the same time that long yields are sinking. Does that look like a green light go-ahead signal to you? I'll tell you what it looks like to me. It looks like the rest of the world is panting and wheezing and getting off the treadmill because they just can't keep up with the U.S. That's why global commodities are tanking, and investors around the world are all funneling their investable assets into America, into fixed income as well as equities, because we're a high rate of return safe haven. And you just can't beat that. And that's why the dollar is rising. If you think this is all good news for America, though, well, I would just say you may need your vision checked for possible myopia. Sure, it may be great for the next few days or maybe the next few weeks, But if all these divergent trends continue, they will not end well. Among other things, I'm extremely suspicious of a stock market surge that coincides with sinking long yields and a reinversion of the yield curve. As I pointed out last week, the 3-month to 10-year yield spread reinverted on January 31st, and it has just skipped in and out of inversion ever since. Yesterday at market close, the yield curve was inverted again by 2 basis points. The 10-year closed at 1.56%, and the 3-month closed at 1.58%. So what is it at the moment that is pushing so much single-minded bullishness in U.S. markets, regardless of what's happening in the rest of the world or in the rest of financial markets? Well, I'll be honest with you. I think a lot of it hinged on President Trump's extraordinary week. The possibility of Trump's re-election this year suddenly ratcheted significantly higher. And that's positive to a lot of global investors who like Trump. And it's even positive to a lot of investors who dislike Trump because it removes uncertainty. The Democratic debates have been generating nothing but question marks for investors. And as we all know, investors hate question marks. Just consider all the things that have gone Trump's way. I mean, most importantly, of course, he got acquitted by the Senate on both impeachment charges on pretty much a party line. Along the way, the House impeachment managers were unable to win a simple majority of the Senate, much less a 2/3 majority. A couple of days later, several GOP leaders announced that they were starting hearings on Hunter Biden's sinecure in the Ukraine, though this may soon become politically irrelevant given Joe Biden's deteriorating performance in the polls. Then you had Trump's State of the Union address the evening before, which was a masterful sound and light show combining the skills of, well, Lee Atwater with those of Leni Riefenstahl. What impressed me most was how well Trump was able to weave together 3 big messages. First, he relentlessly hammered on his economic accomplishments, especially his record employment numbers. You know, this, so much this for Hispanics, this for African Americans, this for the disabled. I mean, he just kept on going on. Secondly, he galvanized support from his base by invoking such threats as open borders, abortion, limitations on school choice, and so forth on down the line. And of course, by giving the American Freedom Award to Rush Limbaugh right there in the House chamber. And third, this is the most interesting actually, he repeatedly celebrated ordinary Americans of color and championed solutions to issues of concern to African Americans, as if to dare the Democrats not to applaud. Now, I don't think he did this in the realistic expectation that he would receive a large share of the black vote in 2020. I think rather he did it to show how aggressively he intends to pursue his Great American Comeback campaign theme. He's willing to take his campaign right into the most solidly Democratic constituency. Many Democratic leaders were enraged by the end of the speech. I mean, Speaker Nancy Pelosi tore her copy of the speech to pieces while dozens of cameras rolled. But I think it's fair to say they weren't just angry, they were shell-shocked. But that's not all. Then there was the fiasco in Iowa, which, as I mentioned last week, reinforced the very worst stereotype about the Democratic leadership. Full of grand ideals, but unable to get simple tasks done. Here is a party that wanted to introduce a complex, super equitable, super transparent preferential voting system. And what did they end up with? Well, it was a chaotic mess. It recalled the, I don't know if you remember this, the healthcare.gov website fiasco during the worst days of Obamacare, when that was rolled out back in 2013. Yet, forget about all the glitches for a moment. The Iowa caucuses also shook Democrats because of the surprisingly low turnout. And recall that Democrats have been promising to break through all the turnout records in 2020. And also because of the disorienting result. The Democrats one sure choice to beat Trump in 2020, Joe Biden, came in at fourth place. He totally fizzled. And of the other two candidates who captured nearly all the voter energy, one was a self-avowed socialist, and the other was a 38-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Now, I actually don't think things are as bleak as a lot of people think for the Democrats, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Democratic race later. But make no mistake, most of the seasoned polls who lead the Democratic Party were shaken by the outcome. And of course, Donald Trump was delighted by it. How much has this helped the president over the last week? Well, I don't know. I think it's unfair to point to Gallup's 49% approval number, which is being cited by many Trump fans. That number is clearly an outlier. But I think it is fair to say that Trump's approval ratings have gained 3 or 4 solid percentage points during the impeachment proceedings and now stand at the highest of his presidency. And by an equal margin, his disapproval ratings have fallen. If you want to know how this shift has affected Trump's odds of winning in 2020, you can just look at the predicted futures markets. Back in early November, it was predicting a Democratic victory by 8 percentage points, 56 to 48%. But today, the odds have shifted to 11 percentage points in the other direction. That is, Trump is ahead 57% to 46%. Most of that new Trump margin was gained in only the last 7, 8, 9, 10 days. Even the U.S. economic numbers were pretty favorable for the president last week. ISM's non-manufacturing PMI for January, it came in at over 60, handily beating expectations and showing ongoing service sector strength. January's NFP employment headline came in at 225,000 new jobs, which was a, you know, solid, if not spectacular, result. Keep in mind, by the way, I might add that the NFP growth rate year over year continues to trend downward, and that according to the CPS household survey, employment actually shrank last month. But of course, the CPS survey has a lot more volatility than the NFP. It also didn't heard last week that China announced that it was cutting its tariff on U.S. exports in half. And what seemed to the media like a hurried effort to comply with its part of the new trade deal. I mean, let's face it, Xi Jinping is reeling from the coronavirus right now, and he seems to be doing everything he can to keep Trump happy. Speaking of the coronavirus, let's move to East Asia. There are few noteworthy economic indicators here to report. The main news, of course, continues to focus on the virus itself. And I think the overall picture remains worrisome, as it has been for the last several weeks. According to the official numbers, 43,000 are now infected. Over 1,000 have died. Roughly 4,000 have recovered. The daily death toll continues to accelerate. Yesterday, it exceeded 100 in 24 hours for the first time. As I've said before, I'm really confident that all these official numbers are gross underestimates. Even if the 1,000 fatality count is accurate, many health experts are pointing out that it is inconceivable that only 4,000 have recovered, unless the mortality rate is up around 20%. Case studies indicate that the actual mortality rate is only around 4%, but that means that the actual infection and recovery numbers must be vastly higher. Current infections may now be in the many hundreds of thousands, and the death count for these will not be known for another 3 or 4 weeks. I find the smooth trend in the reported numbers to be especially disconcerting. Everyone on the ground, and I mean everyone, agrees that infections and deaths in Wuhan were vastly underreported through most of January. Hardly any test kits were available, and sick people were routinely told to just go home and stay isolated there. If reporting has since improved, we should have expected some kink in the lines as all the newly uncovered cases came online. But we haven't seen anything like that. The historical lines in the infected and the fatalities and so on, they're all perversely smooth. A bit like China's GDP numbers. The signs of managed data are everywhere. But, I mean, if the official numbers can't be relied on, what should we be looking at? My suggestion would be activity in the streets of such major urban centers as Shanghai, Guangzhou, and Beijing. Right now, the streets of those cities remain eerily quiet. China's health officials are reassuring the public that the spread of the virus remains largely confined to Hubei province, but I have yet to see any official numbers on infections in any of the other provinces. Well, stay tuned on this story, and there's sure going to be more to come here. In Europe, the economic news was mostly negative. The biggest downer this week was industrial production, which took a big negative hit in nearly every major European country for December. In France, industrial production month over month was down 2.8%, 2.5% below expectations. In Germany, it was down 3.5%. In Italy, it was down 2.7%. Anyway, a very bad December. Meanwhile, Eurozone retail sales were down 1.6% in December. And that's the worst month-over-month Eurozone retail number since going all the way back actually to 2011. So let me sum up my take on the global economic and financial picture as follows. The economy in Europe is not doing well, in part because it has for months been teetering on the brink of recession, and in part because China is importing less from Europe. Well, and from Germany especially, and that situation will definitely not improve as she shifts imports back to the U.S. East Asia is an unknown quantity at present, largely due to the unanswered questions surrounding the coronavirus. The U.S. economy is still chugging along above capacity, which is great for current demand, and which looks even better if you don't pay much attention to the industrial sector or to investment. For me, though, the red lights flashing, or possibly yellow lights flashing, are sinking commodity prices, suggesting contracting global demand, a rising dollar, which will end up hammering emerging markets, and an inverting yield curve, which points again, along with the rising dollar, to the need for the Fed to intervene with lower rates. Further easing, more cowbell, call it what you like. But that's where we're headed. Okay, enough of that. On to politics, where the only really big news story outside America comes from Germany. What happened there? Well, it has to do with Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, AKK, as she is fondly known to her fans. And, well, AKK is stepping down as the leader of Germany's CDU. That's the Christian Democratic Union Party. AKK had long been regarded as the front-runner to succeed Angela Merkel as CDU's candidate for chancellor in 2021 general election. This is all sort of choreographed. You know, it's continuity for the center-right party. The shakeup came after AKK had instructed CDU politicians in Thuringia not to vote for the Free Democrat candidate for that state's local prime minister. And actually, we covered the Thuringia election, I believe, in an earlier podcast. The CDU members defied her wishes and joined the far-right Alternative für Deutschland party in electing the Free Democrat candidate. They wanted to be part of the ruling coalition, basically. The AfD, as I'm sure you know, has been labeled everything from racist to neo-Nazis, particularly in the sort of East German states. The vote for the AfD showed very clearly the weakness of Merkel's successors in being able to keep the CDU unified. It also shows the growing influence of the nationalist right and the extreme left. This is the AfD and Die Linke. These are two parties on the extreme right and extreme left, respectively. And this is steadily weakening the mainstream centrist parties. Germany's Democratic Socialists, that's the SPD, the center-left party, is today only a shadow of its former self. It's been largely replaced on the younger and more progressive side now by the growing Green Party. But it turns out that the CDU, the center-right party, is also weakening. The exit of Angela Merkel in 2021 may mark the end of political centrism in Germany, that is, in Europe's largest economy. And speaking of the rise in populism, let's look for a moment at Ireland. In Dublin, the nationalist party, Sinn Féin, squeaked out a narrow victory in national elections on Monday. The party is best known, Sinn Féin is best known for its IRA origins and also for its steadfast advocacy of reunification with Northern Ireland. It's a populist party, and it has claimed it will try to make a coalition government without Ireland's two main parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. These are the two that have generally been sharing power. It's unclear if there are enough minor parties to shut out the other two. And it's a very interesting situation. It also marks a peculiar challenge to UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, since he now faces the possibility of an eventual exit vote by both Northern Ireland and Scotland. That is to say, if Northern Ireland goes along with Sinn Féin's invitation, right, to have a referendum on this. And now to U.S. politics, where the Democratic Party is praying that the New Hampshire primary goes smoothly. They're bragging right now in New Hampshire that they do politics the old-fashioned way, one countable paper ballot vote per person, period. So everyone is expecting that by tonight, maybe late tonight, we should have a clear winner. Okay, so where do we stand right now on how the candidates are doing? Well, the biggest recent news is this. Joe Biden, for so long the front runner, is right now in a total downward tailspin, and that is fundamentally changing the dynamics of the contest. As you probably already know, Biden came in a poor fourth in Iowa. He came in behind Elizabeth Warren, who in turn came in behind Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, who basically led the caucus results in a virtual tie. Now, I think we can safely say that nothing is worse for a front runner that no one is especially enthusiastic about than to do very poorly once the actual voting starts. And nothing has been worse for Biden. His poll numbers in New Hampshire have plummeted. Back in early January, he was over 20%, leading or tied for first place. Today, he has dropped to 11%, tied with Warren and Klobuchar, and way behind the leaders, Sanders and Buttigieg. The same has happened in national polls. As of yesterday, Biden had sunk to 21% behind Bernie Sanders. So he continues to sink daily. I know. Everyone is telling me that South Carolina is Biden's firewall state and that he can make up for early losses by gaining among African-American Democrats in the South. But I just don't buy it. Once his bubble of inevitability has been punctured, I just don't think he has a future. All those less motivated voters will think, hey, why bother? What's more, he's running out of money. And he's being forced to choose where to cut his ad spend. So where does that leave the Democratic primary? Well, I'll just put my cards on the table. I think Bernie Sanders is getting close to locking this thing up. What does Bernie have going for him? Well, let's just think about what he has going for him. For starters, He has total authenticity and a fiercely loyal cadre of core supporters. And by the way, that's why no one tries to attack him in the debates. The other candidates know there is almost no chance of persuading a Sandinista to vote for anyone else. So he gets away unscathed, really. Second, he has youth on his side. No one comes close to Bernie's share of Democrats under age 30. He's also way out ahead of other candidates with voters age 30 to 50. And that includes millions of, you know, late wave Xers. Now, I don't know about you, but when your party establishment is discredited and you're trying to unseat an incumbent in the other party, I'd rather have the energy of youth on my side, wouldn't you? Biden, by the way, has exactly the inverse demographic profile of Sanders. He's the low-energy favorite of seniors. And you just saw where that got him and where that's getting him. Third, Sanders has working-class appeal. One big plus for Joe Biden was that he could attract non-college Democrats. But Sanders is the only other candidate that can attract these voters. Here is one large advantage Sanders has over Warren and Buttigieg. He just doesn't come across as a super wonk for the brainy collegiate set. Number four, let's talk about race. Although Bernie's appeal to African Americans remains an issue, he's doing better among blacks, especially among young blacks, than he did in 2016 when Hillary beat him so badly in the South. And if Biden turns out to be non-viable, where else are these African American voters going to go? Not to Buttigieg or Warren, that's for sure. Maybe to Mike Bloomberg, the billionaire Jewish ex-mayor of New York, famous for stop and frisk policing? I don't know. That seems not terribly confident about that. That strikes me maybe as a stretch. What's more, it turns out that Bernie is more popular than any other Democratic candidate among Hispanic voters. And that could help him big time on Super Tuesday. Like, for example, in California, where Bernie is now well ahead in the race to win those 494 delegates. And finally, Sanders has money. That's right. Of all the candidates who are self-funding billionaires like Steyer and Bloomberg, Sanders has the most money on hand, over $100 million. More importantly, everyone knows he can raise more money at a moment's notice just by asking his supporters for help. So he's got everything on tap. Biden sure can't do that. He's tried. And because so much of Sanders' money is raised in small donations, Sanders is the only candidate that can actually use his money as a campaign statement. Look, I get my support from ordinary Americans. Well, so you might want to ask the question, who else is going to beat Bernie? Elizabeth Warren? In my opinion, she's fading. She made some terrible mistakes in her campaign, the worst of which, according to James Carville, and I agree with him, was to try to outcompete Sanders on the left on all the wrong issues. Bernie is going to the economic left. Warren, in response, tried going way out to the cultural left. But that's a big mistake in today's America. Bill Mayer on his show, he recently teased Warren about her intention not to appoint a Secretary of Education until that person had been vetted by a transsexual teenager. And Mayer's response was, "Isn't this the crazy stuff that Barack Obama told the Democrats to avoid? What's she running for anyway? President of Berkeley?" We'll see how long Warren can stick it out. If and when she does drop out, surveys indicate that most of her voters will go to Bernie, pushing up his standing even further. Okay, there is Pete Buttigieg. Okay, Pete Buttigieg is he did very well in Iowa. He seems to be rising in New Hampshire. But if Pete wants to go all the way, he'd better get a clear victory in a few of these educated, affluent, and white northeastern states, because he's never going to get a better shot. Pete is definitely not going to perform well in the South. He has next to no support from African Americans, And he still is doing only around 10% in national polls. He's way behind in California, for example, at 7% versus Bernie Sanders at 26%. Well, that's a big gap. Yes, Pete is the millennial candidate, but as I have pointed out here several times, he is not attracting the millennial voter. The age distribution of Buttigieg supporters is actually similar to Joe Biden's, not to Bernie Sanders. Finally, there's Mike Bloomberg. And sure, Bloomberg has some big strengths. He's smart, he's articulate, he's a moderate who can plausibly fill the role of mainstream standard bearer now being vacated by Joe Biden. And you could say maybe it's no accident that as Biden's poll numbers have sunk, Bloomberg's numbers have risen. But we should be careful here. In Pew's recent examination of voters' second choices, and we discussed this actually in yesterday's Newswire, Pew found that actually very few of Biden's supporters would go to Bloomberg if Biden dropped out. Most would go to Bernie Sanders, and the rest to Warren and Buttigieg, respectively. Working class Democrats may be ideological moderate, but they are also working class, and they are also Democrats, which means that they may have a hard time voting for an independent New York billionaire who buys his way into the nomination. Bloomberg obviously has unlimited funding, but all that money, I think, is likely to become a salient campaign issue, and not in a good way for Bloomberg. If Bloomberg is the last man standing in Bernie's way, I can't think of any other candidate Bernie would rather have opposite him on the debating platform. I mean, think of it. Bernie would just love it. Right on stage, Exhibit A, a living example of the plutocracy that is destroying America. A guy who can just use his money to buy ads and bribe the DNC into changing rules so he can, well, steal the nomination. Bernie will have a field day. One last thought. As it becomes increasingly likely that Bernie Sanders may become the Democratic nominee in 2020, the mood from Trump supporters is becoming predictably jubilant. Trump's got this made. America will never elect a loony lefty socialist, you know, all that kind of thing. But I would urge Republicans to be cautious, and I will return to a remark I made at the beginning of this podcast. Do you recall how happy, deliriously happy, Hillary Clinton and the top Democratic leaders were back in 2016 when the GOP finally settled on Donald Trump as their candidate? Why? Because America would never elect a shady reality show tycoon who knows nothing about politics. So contemplate that for a second. Will America really care that much in 2020 about words like socialist? Any more than they cared in 2016 about words like isolationist or protectionist? I'm not sure they will. Here's what I think. We live in an era of rising populism and of a rising hunger for radical solutions to big national challenges. Back in 2016, the Republican Party tapped into this populist energy. In 2020, the Democratic Party may be doing the same. I do agree that if Bernie is nominated, he'll have a tough challenge ahead of him, especially if the U.S. economy remains as strong as it is today. But the economy may change. And more importantly, the American electorate may yet fall for a new enthusiasm that could blindside today's populist-in-chief. Imagine another populist with supporters just as blindly devoted and loyal to their leader. How certain are you about how it will turn out? Thanks for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Talk to you next week. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Demography Unplugged. Tune in next time. If you have any questions about this broadcast or have suggestions for future topics, please contact QADemography@hedgeye.com. Also, if you'd like to see more of what I have to offer, visit us online at hedgeye.com, and also make sure to follow me on Twitter at HoweGeneration. That's H-O-W-E, Generation.
Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.